Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway thanks to the music of the immortal Pete Seeger with that great song. One of these days, Alan and I are going to get together and we'll do a little duet on this one.
Yeah, because you play the, how you say that thing?
Ukulele.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the ukulele.
Which is the trendy instrument now, you know.
It is.
What's that you play?
I play the banjo, which is a much more difficult instrument.
You know all the banjo jokes, don't you? You know.
Yeah. Well, they're going to have a whole lot of ukulele jokes now.
How do you tune a banjo, you know, put the car in drive after you've had it in reverse or something like that?
Throw it in the dumpster.
I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, and Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist, professor at the University of Albany. Do you play an instrument? Yeah, well,
a piano lessons for years, but no, I don't.
Piano lessons,
no,
yeah, what do you know?
Put them on the list. List. Franz Liszt.
Got it.
You got it.
How do you make a trombone player's car more aerodynamic? You take the pizza delivery sign off the top. You see, I used to play the trombone, so
you are so clearly a Midwesterner.
Really terrible,
that,
yeah,
you know.
It's great,
I mean,
stuff.
Your jokes are so
it's
so
amazing
wanting.
That I've managed to make any splash at all in the sophisticated world of Northeastern media.
But a splash you have. You've become king of media. That's why they call you Rex.
We really need to get to the important issues of the day.
Thank goodness.
Let's talk about Ukraine, really. I think that the situation remains fluid as we speak. But one of the more interesting elements, if we want to approach it from the standpoint of a media analysis program, is the way in which the situation there has really been shaped by a new approach to media. Rosemary, you really are an expert on this.
My group is involved in this, the group I work with overseas, and I was in Ukraine this summer. And it's historic what's going on there. The journalists were killed in horrifying numbers or wounded in the protests leading up. And the
Do you think they were targeted?
Absolutely, yeah. They were targeted. Right. So then the government leaves. And as they're leaving, the president dumps in the boat that he's escaping from hundreds of files. And the journalists round up divers who volunteer to go in. And they bring up, it's like 200 files. It's a massive number of files. And through this huge effort, people are bringing them food and supplies, and they've spread out these papers all over a villa, and they're drying them off, photocopying them, digging through them for stories. They've put up a website. And what you have is an international project. Rex, you will have heard of this. I don't know about you, Alan, but in 1975, a U.S. journalist, Don Bowles, who worked on organized crime issues, was killed. His car exploded in the middle of downtown Arizona, city in Arizona. And it took like 11 days for him to die. It was horrible. And in the aftermath of his death, 45 journalists from around the country descended on Arizona and Phoenix, and they did his story. They worked on his story. They did it far more massively than he might ever have been able to do alone. And the message was, you can kill the reporter, but you can't kill the story. Mm-hmm. And I am so impressed and proud of my friends that they're part of an international effort along those lines.
It's a wonderful thing. And while it's unclear yet what they will find from this, It's just such an impressive element that people will come together, notwithstanding personal danger.
They have guards watching any kind of noise outside, and they're jumping at it because they're expecting the police to descend on them.
Well, yeah.
Some of the first stories are coming out. They're being translated because, of course, we can't read them. They're in English and in Ukrainian and Russian right now. But the first ones are showing incredible expenditures by the government. You would expect that. We've seen that every other place that we've had dictators fall. But they're documented. It's in their own documents of the dictators. Why do human beings keep papers?
Well, as I keep reminding everybody, the way we know so much about the Holocaust is the Nazis kept meticulous records.
One of the things that you kind of have to hope when you see something like this is the ongoing nature of it. Now, arising from the Arizona Project, Rosemary, of course, came the organization that you used to lead, Investigative Reporters and Editors, which is the largest organization of working journalists in America now, and does encourage investigative reporting around the country and around the world. And you have to hope that rising from this situation in Ukraine could be a similar spirit that will continue to have investigative reporting in these countries where there is such tumult in government that you really need to have the staying power of the press.
There actually is much of a movement like that. As I said, I've been working with these people for a long time. But you're right. This will popularize it. This will make other media say, hey, we have to get into this and do it more. I hope it'll get them some more money eventually.
And you might get younger people, even more younger people, who want to go into journalism, even though there are fewer jobs, and excite them the way, the way Woodward and Bernstein did. Mm-hmm. There was this huge influx. Can I just raise an issue with you, Rosemary and Rex, that I find fascinating, and that is the historical context of this battle, the way it's being posed, the Russians versus the West, and yet I did a Vox Pop where people call in the other day, and we had a lot of Ukrainian voices on the air, some of whom were saying, everybody knows that the Western group are, quote, the fascists, and that they are not the Democrats they lay themselves out to be. But the natural tendency is we, they, in our society, to report on this as Putin's flexing his muscles and the good people in the West revolted against the president. And I'm wondering whether or not we as journalists or others have to set the sort of context of where all of these people were, where they're coming from, and what their antecedents were.
Well, this is, I think, the great challenge of good journalism is to go beyond the black and white, the easy stick figure accounts that are somewhat made for cable television. You know, it's easy to get the kind of, as you say, Alan, the East-West, because we're so familiar with that model from Cold War images, from what we grew up with.
And from sports.
And from sports,
the good guys and the bad guys. You can see that in the coverage that where the American media is very much trying to push it back. Oh, wow, East-West, we get this, rather than what's really going on there, which is Russian ethnic people have been put back into the Ukraine on purpose by a previous Russian administration.
They do
sincerely have an interest in joining with Russia. And on both sides, the Western-backed administrations and the Russian, they're so terribly corrupt. So in all of this, the people have continued to lose. And this revolution was remarkable for the young people and the adults who went there and risked their lives and died for this. There really is this inbred desire for democracy. We've seen it all through the Arab countries and now here.
And then you watch the inevitable happen, which is the iron law of oligarchy. One person becomes the sort of head spokesman. And then history often, not always, but often repeats itself. And you get people running the show who may have made great and grandiose statements in the beginning, but who turn out to follow the same selfish instincts that others have before
them. I've been talking for days on the roundtable about Yulia Tymoshenko. I cannot believe she is back as a heroine again. She had her shot, and she insisted on infighting with the administration and was caught up in some horrible corruption herself. So find somebody new. And I think they have. I think some of the leaders of this revolution will be that new voice, that new face.
One of the interesting developments here was pointed out to me by a young woman who is here in Albany on a Fulbright Fellowship, finishing her master's degree at the College of St. Rose. She spoke of the power of social media in exciting and inciting the demonstrations. The initial demonstrations arising from the, was it in November the 16th or whenever it was, that the government in Kiev actually went forward with a plan to ally financially, economically with Moscow rather than with the West. The initial demonstrations drew only about 400 people, but social media subsequently went out under a couple of hashtags that became well known on Twitter, and thousands of people, and then finally a million people on, I think, December the 30th, descended upon what would be their translation of Freedom Square in the demonstrations.
So, your point being, this is the new journalism.
The new journalism. It is, well, and it is actually,
it's,
I guess calling it journalism is right.
It's activism, too. It's a combination of news going out and activism. Come and be with us.
So. And, you know, there's so much information. I get up very early in the morning, 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was listening to the BBC on the way over from Great Barrington, Massachusetts, to Albany, and they had Tomashenko, his daughter, on, talking about her mother and how her mother never was corrupt and never this and that. So there are all of these voices that are competing for space one place or another. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Stephen Sacker, who interviewed her on a program called Hard Talk, mm-hmm. and he's not a nice man, you know. It was fascinating to see the kind of defenses that they're all putting up.
So let's turn over to this side of the Atlantic if we can. If you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Mayo, and Rex Smith here. And if you want to be a part of the conversation, you can send email to media@wamc.org. That'd be a great thing. There was an extraordinary full-page ad in the New York Times one day last week announcing the establishment of Playwriting Prize, a $45,000 prize annually to be given out by a new group called the American Playwriting Foundation. And guess what this is a result of? It's a result of the National Enquirer making a payment to settle a libel claim, to basically close down a libel case that had been brought by a guy named David Barr Katz, who was Philip Seymour Hoffman's great friend. You know?
But not lover.
But not lover. And that's the apparent thing. It was David Barr Katz who found the body of his friend Philip Seymour Hoffman. And it was kind of a remarkable thing because in the National Enquirer and online, there appeared this story saying that they were gay lovers and that that's why he was going to visit him. This is untrue.
Completely untrue. Seymour Hoffman is has had a longtime partner. They have three children. And in fact, the friendship between the two men is in part because their children go to the same schools.
Mm-hmm.
So when Katz's son's 14-year-old son says, "Dad, you know, there's something on the radio about you and Seymour being lovers," he goes, "Oh, Phil would get a kick out of that if you." So it was never checked out. Well,
okay,
you can explain how it happened.
But it must have been a big payoff because to throw off $45,000 a year on this prize means you've got to have a lot of principles.
Katz refused to say how much, but he did mention that there was money for awards for several years to come.
Isn't that something? Isn't that amazing? Now, you think about this. When you see the National Enquirer on the newsstand and you see these outrageous stories, frequently headlines exceeding what the stories actually say. You
know,
the headlines are great exaggerations. You wonder, how can they get away with this? And I have a friend who, when he first came out of Columbia Journalism School, you know, after spending all this money to get this prestigious master's degree,
which you have. You actually graduated first in your class in that same program.
Thank you very much. Yeah. but I did not have to go to work for the National Enquirer. I actually had an offer to go work for a shopper in Louisville, Kentucky, or to go to work for Newsday temporarily, and I took the latter, which was a great choice. But anyway, this fellow went to work for the National Enquirer, and he said that the way that they avoid lawsuits was that they really did hire journalists, guys who were down in their luck or had mm-hmm. had bad experiences, and the folks...
Easy to find these days.
Yes, exactly.
You know, their instincts are even right. I mean, when Hoffman died, I said, "Matt, you never hear about his family. Is he gay?" I mean, it's a question that's on. So they tapped into that. The problem was that they listened to a guy who said, "Yeah, I'm David Katz." It wasn't the right David Katz.
Right.
Is the problem.
They interviewed a guy by phone.
Yeah. Yeah, they interviewed a guy by phone and didn't check further into mm-hmm. his...
Well, Rex, I think this is a point in Rosemary. I think you may have made it also, that in the past, when these kinds of newspapers, this typology, gets sued, it's often seen as the price of doing business.
Yeah.
In other words, okay, so we have to pay off, but we're selling a lot of newspapers.
Here's the interesting thing. Yesterday, when our producer, David Gossina, sent out this as a possible story that we might talk about, I looked it up, and the story is still there, the whole story about the two guys. But yeah, it's not taken down. If I were Katz, I might be saying, let's add a little bit more to that pot until you want to take down the story. So they're still getting hits on it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you do have to wonder, as a business operates, I wonder if they actually keep a reserve, if they have to keep money on hand.
Or if they pay a lot of money for insurance.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty amazing. Anyway, it's a good ending to what was a ridiculous episode, and you just kind of have to hope that that kind of thing won't happen going forward. Meanwhile,
I'll bet you it will.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess.
Sometimes ineptitude, sometimes malice.
In New York State, we've been treated to quite a little show, a fight between New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and a newspaper called the New York Observer, a weekly, rather small circulation weekly in Manhattan, published on salmon-colored paper, that published an amazing, lengthy, what you might call a takedown piece on Eric Schneiderman. A hit, they might say. Not in hit as in a hit record, but quite an attack.
Eric Schneiderman, the very competent Attorney General of the state of New York, who has been at odds with Donald Trump.
And Mr. Trump's relationship to the New York Observer is?
Go ahead.
His son-in-law owns it.
His son-in-law owns it.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't really stop there. So he has this relationship, and I'm sure this is the very first time an editor of a paper has abused their authority by saying, go get him, whether his name is, his name is Trump or name is Shartok.
You know, that's kind of the benefit of having a newspaper. And I say, if you're a pro-Trump and you want to defend him, go do it. There's your facility. There's your vehicle for it. However, it's such a horrible job. It actually hurt the newspaper far more than it does, than it does Schneiderman. It's just an inept hack job. It's horrible.
I had forgotten that Trump had those hooks into the newspaper.
Yeah.
In other words, I think everybody now knows that, and I don't think Trump is the most popular figure on the front.
I think it has denigrated the Observer into the same status as the Washington Times.
Absolutely.
You know, it's basically print for hire.
I mean, if you had written a story saying, hey, we have real deep connections here, we want to tell you about them up front, but now we're going to take a look at a serious topic, I'd say great. But they used many, I read it briefly on the roundtable, and then
You should explain
it,
the roundtable, because this program goes to a lot of different places, but the Roundtable is a very popular program right here at WAMC, the host station for this program.
Very popular. Two of the three people in this room are on the program all the time.
Well,
that's
right.
What makes it popular.
Well, that's right.
is your nose out of shape, Rex?
You
visit too, Rex.
There's a little favoritism.
He's always. He's always.
But the point is.
No. I'm not done yet. He's always. He's always invited to be on the roundtable, and I know that he's doing other things. Why, for example, I saw his picture prominently displayed in his own newspaper just this morning.
Hell yes. Ooh.
Getting back to our attorney general.
Yes, indeed.
As my twin brother once said to me, you started it.
The attorney general story, you were saying?
This story is filled with unnamed sources who take long, withering attacks on Schneiderman. This is not allowed in legitimate newspapering. You don't put an unnamed source hammering your person. It's got so much content from Donald Trump. He had a free, you know, space to just say whatever he wanted. And in contrast, Schneiderman is not quoted at all. It just simply says in one sentence that he was not available for comment. It's just a horrible piece of work.
Two responses, one from the Village Voice the day of publication, I think, later in the day after the piece came out in the Observer. The Village Voice online published by the numbers analysis of how many words were quoting or defending Donald Trump and the length of the very extraordinary reporting notes that explained, basically justified what they were doing with this. I've never seen anything quite like this. Then subsequently in the New York Times, the day after the story, there was an interview with the young man who had initially been hired to do the piece, the
first
freelancer,
yeah.
Who quit when he said he was sure that what he was being asked to do.
That was huge,
hit piece.
Don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That the guy who was assigned to write the piece.
And he was a 28-year-old clerk in a convenience store. Didn't have experience much doing journalism. And imagine that you would hire that person to do a freelance piece on the Attorney
General. That kid, who obviously is dependent on a paycheck and everything else, had the guts to say no.
Yeah, very interesting. So,
you should hire that kid.
Maybe I should hire that kid. More on that to come, but it does go to show that the power of the press is not unlimited. You know, as we point out, the New York Observer lost more than it gained by going through this, I think. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true. You know, there are always those moments when, as the great folk singer Christine Lavin wrote a song called What Could They Have Been Thinking? You know, that don't they ever anticipate this? You know, Chris Christie's people close a lane when he was going to overwhelmingly win an election. Dick Nixon invades the Watergate. For what reason did he do that when he knew he was going to win? What is with these people and that they make these kinds of mistakes? Is it sheer arrogance? I don't know.
And then, of course, as we have said before in this program, the cover-up ends up being more problematic. This is what Nixon's problem ended up being. You know, when the White House raised $1 million of hush money, or paid out $1 million of hush money from a secret account to try to cover up what went on, and when the all the way up to the president, they were trying to conceal the felonious activity, it would have been much better for him to, right from the get-go, jettison those people involved and say, this is not the way we do politics. But of course it was.
There's the problem.
That would have been wrong,
sure.
As to quote Mr. Nixon. However, in the interaction of government and reporters, it's not always so smooth, and that has particularly been the case in the Obama administration, which has been more aggressive than other previous administrations in going after reporters, trying to compel their testimony, trying to plug leaks that have gone to reporters. And now, as a result of a lot of protests by journalism organizations and by editorial pages, the Attorney General of the country, Eric Holder, has announced some new guidelines intending to somewhat protect journalists from intrusion by federal prosecutors.
Well, of course, the Justice Department and Holder himself have not come out, and the president have not come out as being particularly friendly to the press. And I think they take a look at the president's upside-down numbers now and realize that the great transmission belt is the press in terms of people's perceptions, and they make a decision to try to remediate.
You know, the federal government went after the AP. They did not tell the AP in advance that they were collecting a massive amount of the telephone records of the Associated Press. They made secret use of a search warrant to obtain emails from Fox News. There has been a lot of what we in journalism can consider to be intrusive behavior in violation of the usual standards that apply to protect the First Amendment.
Sure.
It's evident from what you said. We understand why the government had to issue these guidelines. However, the guidelines are far from safety for journalists. The same thing could happen that already did with the AP. There are so many exemptions built into these now written rules. They can just basically throw them out the window if, for example, telling the news organization we want your information would pose a clear and substantial threat to the integrity of an investigation. Man, you can say that almost all the time. So I'm glad that they are saying at least that they want to protect journalists' rights, but I'm not sure that they actually have.
Well, there has to be a tension, obviously, between, you know, the press and the government, which we have always seen. But I suspect, having listened to this show a few times, that any time there is such a tension, that you and Rex will always be on the side of the press, no matter what it is. Right?
I will be, and that's not a bad thing. There should be more of us on that side, Alan. We've given up way too many rights in the name of safety, and then we have to, at least having it in writing, I will say, at least having these guidelines debated and discussed and presented will give lawyers for media organizations something to go to court over.
And it does require the specific personal approval of the Attorney General before this can happen. Now, that was supposedly in place before, but there is the sensibility that
before bad things can happen,
before they're allowed to actually seize these records, before they're allowed to impose the exceptions that Rosemary's noted, for example.
And we will be watching. The media is now on notice that free press doesn't mean all that it used to, and we're going to be howling and screaming when we see violations.
Well, that's there are always people on the other side too, Rosemary. I mean, one of the people who has been most critical of some of the behavior of the press has been Alec Baldwin, who tends to use his fists at the right moment,
and not his head, or maybe he's banged his head too many times.
Profanity at his children too.
Or maybe he keeps himself in the headlines by doing this way.
He should stick to acting. He's a very, very good actor.
He is.
He's a great American comic actor. It's just too bad that he's stark raving mad. But it's, I don't really mean that in case he's feeling litigious.
Right. You're just whatever. So what else you got?
Whatever. Well, we're now at the end of the program, and I think that it's time to take note of the correction of the week. It's often nice to poke to people's big problems. And here is one. A Washington Post story about the capture of a Mexican drug lord was corrected in the Washington Post by this. An earlier version of this story erroneously said that Joaquin Guzman was found in bed with his secretary. He was found with his wife. this version
well,
has been corrected.
Well, that could be prejudicial. On the other hand, who are you prejudicing against?
One of the
world's greatest drug runners?
If I were the wife, I'd be complimented. You know, she's hot enough to be taken as a mistress. Cool.
Excellent news. Yeah. That's a great way to think of it.
Rex, I'm interested in, Alan, you may have something to say about this, too. There was a toxic ash spill at a Duke Energy power plant in North Carolina. They did a lot to try to cover it up. An AP reporter and photographer got in a boat, went on the river, stuck their hand in the river, and came out with their hand all covered in muck. It's this wonderful graphic proof that something bad had happened.
Visual storytelling can sometimes be the most compelling thing. A single image can sometimes do as much as 1,000 words.
It was all mucked up.
Picture is worth and all of that. That's all for the Media Project this week. We will hope to have you back next week. And now here's Pete.
See, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.